This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, September 5th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. In an era of helicopter parenting, something has been lost. The concept of safety has crept so far that it often includes the dubious right of emotional safety. And violators better watch out. What does that mean for young people in the workforce, in academia, in politics, and the ability of those people to bounce back from failure? Greg Lukianoff is author with Jonathan Haidt of The Coddling of the American Mind. We spoke last week. As we were talking before we began recording about children and this overwhelming desire that parents will recognize to protect their kids from, you know, what seems sometimes feels like in retrospect pretty mundane, not particularly threatening dangers, it's really hard to combat. And yet we really want to do that. And it seems that we have institutions now that carry the kind of protection that parents want to provide their kids for many, many years. How did we get here?
You know, my pet theory on this, I talked a little bit about it in a short book called Freedom from Speech. And at the time, I called these problems of comfort. But in the book, we refer to these as problems of progress because we think that's actually a little bit more accurate. And that essentially, you know, having a society where we have enough sort of free time and leisure and to move on to second order things like how well protected my kids are is actually a relatively good problem to have. But that doesn't mean it doesn't create very serious problems of its own. And for a long time, there was a very commonsensical rationale that look at all these strides we've made by being concerned about child safety, very real strides that came to, you know, at lower fatalities due to car accidents, to paint, to poisons. We actually made a lot of progress in this way. So, you know, if a little bit of being concerned with safety is good, what's the downside of being completely obsessed with it? And there wasn't a lot of people saying that there were real downsides for a long, for at least, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years. But people like me and my co-author John Haidt and Lenore Skenazy, the famous free-range kids mom, are pointing out that there actually are consequences to trying too hard to overprotecting children that are real and meaningful, including one of the things that we point out in the book is if you take away a kid's sort of locus of control, a sense that they're in control of their own lives, that's a perfect formula for anxiety and depression.
You know, when I've spoken with others about this idea of problems that are created by prosperity, obesity is one. And, you know, we conquered the problem of hunger. And so we get the problem, the probably much less serious problem.
But a problem nonetheless.
But a problem nonetheless of obesity. So to the extent that parents or adults in the world are realizing that there is a problem that we've created, not for ourselves, but for our kids, you know, what do you view as sort of the first inkling that that was actually the case, that there was this recognition?
You know, for the chapters on parenting, which are actually among my personal two favorite chapters in the book, we interviewed three different experts. Of course, we interviewed Lenore Skenazy. We also talked to Julie Lithcott-Hames, who wrote a great book called How to Raise an Adult. And she learned about this problem from being the dean of freshmen at Stanford going back to 2000. She was at the law school when I was at the law school as well back in 1997, I think. We also talked to Erica Christakis, who is a Yale, formerly used to teach at Yale. She is a child psychology expert. And all of them came to the same conclusion from different directions. Julie started seeing parents increasingly getting involved in the lives of their nominally adult children at Stanford. And it just seemed to get a little bit worse every year, that kids were increasingly in touch with their parents to make even tiny decisions for them. And she realized this had a psychological toll on students. They really felt like they'd never been taught to feel sort of competent or that they could sort of handle their own lives on their own, which is, of course, an incredibly harmful thing to do to your kids if you think about it. Lenore came to this point of view, of course. You know, she has a very punchy story about this, but it's true. She had her son asked her if he could take the New York subway by himself during the day with a cell phone in order to get home. And she let him do this. It went fine. He felt great about it. She wrote about the experience and scandalized the entire New York area, got tremendous amounts of hate mail, was called the world's worst mom. And that really brought home to her that that you can never be too safe and you can never be too careful thing might be actually disempowering our kids. Erica Christakis's point of view comes from working with kids in preschool. And her concern is that in some ways we are avoiding things that give kids a sense of sort of competence and we're pushing down fourth grade level kind of like direct instruction down even into preschools. And that's interfering with the kid's ability just to be a kid, to play with risk and figure out things on their own.
I've heard Lenore Skenazy talk about the fact that there is a huge marketing apparatus prepared to take advantage of your unwillingness to spend just a few more dollars here and there and here and there all the time to protect your kids from, you know, increasingly small slivers of danger. But what you're talking about is in some ways the fear that strangers or other parents will look askance and say to you that, you know, you're being a bad parent, and that would really hurt. That would really sting.
Yeah, the social stigma is definitely something that accelerates all this. That essentially, if you're not the most paranoid parent, you get looked at as a bad parent. So you have to create sort of free-range kid communities. That's actually kind of a first step, is find other parents who are kind of like, this is crazy. Can my kids play with your kids outside? You know, but the real, like the one that really kicks things into overdrive that's gotten a lot of coverage, you know, from Reason Magazine, for example, is the arresting of parents for letting their kids, you know, play in the park, walk to school, all of this stuff that, you know, people from my generation before all took for granted we could do and was a good and positive thing. In some cases, some of our happiest memories from our childhood were, you know, walking home from school alone on a regular basis. And at least for me, maybe I'm a weird person in that respect. The fact that people are actually getting in legal trouble, that's like the first thing you have to solve. So if people think there's any danger of getting arrested for having free range kids, they're just not going to do it. So we're helping Lenore out and spreading the word about states like Utah that actually even passed laws saying, like, listen, you know, if that you shouldn't be arresting parents for letting their kids walk to school above a certain age.
Yeah, but it's more than that. At least in Utah, it's an affirmative defense. It's an affirmative statement that children are entitled to alone time out and about, and parents are entitled to give it to them.
Yeah, it's a great, well, in my opinion, well thought out reform. Also, what a previous generation would have considered complete common sense, of course, but the common sense of one generation is not necessarily that of the next.
Okay, so you know, given some of the growing sort of institutional understanding, in a way that parents need to be, as I talked with Lenore about this very subject, need to be regular readers of Fretful Mother magazine, but you know, even in high school and college, you mentioned even at a school like Stanford, yep, parents becoming more and more involved. What do we understand, or what do we know now about the impact that has on young people attempting to assert themselves in the world?
Right. Well, that was the interesting thing about what led Height and I to write this book. We originally wrote an article called Coddling of the American Mind back in 2015, more based on anecdotal evidence that we had of universities reporting increases in anxiety and depression on campus. And it, you know, we had stories about, you know, psychological services being overwhelmed at different schools. But the hard evidence that there really was an increase in anxiety and depression wasn't quite there yet. Right when we started writing the book, though, the data came in for the class coming in 2016. And what we realized was if we were evaluating the psychological situation in colleges, we should have been looking at the psychological situation in the feeders, in high schools. And there was such a dramatic jump in rates of anxiety and depression and, horribly enough, suicide, both attempts and successful attempts, just from the 2012 cohort of students to the 2016 cohort of students. Something really dramatic had happened. And we believe this is at least in part due to a generation who have not been given that sort of sense of independence, that sense of locus of control, that sense of I can do this on my own, which is incredibly disempowering and is, you know, a textbook way to make someone feel anxious and depressed. Now, of course, we hear horror stories all the time about individual students who feel they've never been given a chance to sort of exercise their own agency. But it's the fact that it's showing up so dramatically in the data as well is really alarming. So I actually remember when, you know, we wrote the article kind of predicting that this was going to get worse. And John, when he looked at the data for 2016, was like, well, it looks like we were right. And I remember just being like, oh, my God, like given like how dramatic the jump was, we were like, I really wish we weren't.
For every problem, there is an opportunity in a way. And what has been the opportunity identified by bureaucratic institutions that want to, I mean – you know, it's nobody's hope that kids be ill prepared for life. But, you know, to the extent there are people who are reporting needs, you know, what has been the institutional response? What's been the bureaucratic response?
Well, as the president and CEO of FHIR, I'm looking at at universities. And the way universities have responded to, you know, the increased sort of what we talk about as moral dependency on campus, and the genuine increase in psychological problems that you see, particularly at the more elite institutions, some of the things they've done make perfect sense. Try to make more psychological services available, but other approaches that they've taken, you know, whether or not it's talking about having trigger warnings or increasingly policing speech in the form of microaggressions. Or just trying to make the atmosphere increasingly unthreatening, we argue consistently is wrong-headed and likely to backfire. That essentially, if you try to rather than make this to prepare the student for the road, as we stay, but instead try to prepare the road for the student, you're going in the wrong direction. And this is why we think we've seen a lot more sort of clamping down from students themselves on free speech issues since around 2013, 2014. This kind of misguided belief that essentially we can protect mental health if only we defer to the political activists we like the most. It ends up being kind of a weirdly disconnected thing, because if you're arguing for this person can't speak on campus because someone has PTSD, to me, that's actually playing politics with a severe mental condition that someone may or may not have. And actually, in a sense, both trivializing it and not taking it seriously enough.
In terms of group dynamics, what does that create on campus? And can you draw that line as clearly as you might hope that you could?
One of the interesting differences between the article that we wrote in 2015 and the book was in 2015, we were more or less putting forward the theory that we should see an increase in anxiety and depression among students because we're teaching a generation the habits of anxious and depressed people. And what we mean by that is catastrophizing, overgeneralizing, all of these things that in the field of cognitive behavioral therapy, you know that if you have this interior dialogue that's really sort of exaggerated, you're going to feel anxious and depressed. What we added to now we went much deeper into this in the book, and we found out some really interesting things, really interesting trends, a lot more data. But the thing that's completely different about this book than the original article is that we also go into political polarization. We also go into this sort of contributing factor, but also sort of side factor, where we Not only are we teaching a generation the habits of anxious and depressed people, we are teaching them the habits of highly tribalized, highly polarized people. You know, and I was warning about this going back to a long time, that if you have institutions of censorship, for example, like if you have speech codes, which most campuses did up until fairly recently, like very bad speech codes, that is what I mean by that. Most campuses still have some kind of speech code. That doesn't really change people's minds. It just encourages them to talk to the people they already agree with and to keep their mouth shut on controversial issues among people that won't they think might disagree, which is, you know, one way of keeping the peace, but of course exactly the opposite of what you want happening on campus. Now, the social science on what happens when you have people just talking with their own echo chambers and with their own groups is very, very strong. You end up with this sort of increasing group polarization cycle, you know, that Cass Sunstein, for example, is one person who writes a lot about, but that, you know, there's lots of experiments done to this extent. And it leads to a very sort of us versus them mentality. And you can certainly see that on campuses going back, you know, at least 5 years. We at FIRE saw a very big uptick in this mentality among students. And one thing I always have to be clear about, I started working at FIRE in 2001. You know, when I, and most of my career when I was dealing with censorship and political correctness on campus, the people who were pushing it were not students. They were administrators and sometimes occasionally professors. Students were absolutely the best constituency on campus for freedom of speech from my entire career from 2001 to about 2013. And something happened around 2013 that suddenly we were on the opposite side of students who were arguing for increased restrictions on speech all of a sudden. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, John and I decided to write the article and ultimately the book is to try to figure out why did this happen so quickly? What's the what changed? And we, in the book, the whole book is basically a social science detective story of trying to figure out what changed in that short period of time.
So with respect to students on campus having become, or I guess more willing to have their own speech abridged in the interest of some sort of general welfare on campus, what does that do for students or do to students that might otherwise like to speak out on behalf of people who are accused of having done something wrong?
E-liberal students result in just the worsening of sort of the polarization spiral. It pushes, again, people talking to just those that they agree with. But it also has negative impacts on professors because if you don't actually have a constituency that you can always appeal to and make the argument, you know, my freedom of speech is at stake without getting sneered at, it creates an environment where, you know, professors can get picked off, speakers can get picked off. And then, of course, you know, have the really scary, dramatic examples that I'd never seen anything like, at least during my career, were the Milo riots back in 2017, what happened to Heather McDonald when she went to Claremont McKenna, I believe it was, the Alison Sanger, who was badly injured, defending Charles Murray at Middlebury around the same time. And I know that there was campus violence, you know, in response to speakers back in the 70s. And in a lot of ways, you know, that violence was a lot worse. During my career, though, I'd never seen anything like this. And seeing the sort of like your words are violence and therefore my violence is free speech, it's a scary trend because it really leads into an uncontrollable situation. And you know what I was saying when this started happening back in 2017, I was like, listen, we've got to get a handle on this because eventually this is going to mean someone gets killed.
To what extent have state and federal regulations and fear of liability driven schools and, let's say, the Department of Education, for example, to respond? How have they responded?
Federal regulations and liability are sort of the secret engine of what makes things so much worse on campus. And it's something we talk a fair amount. We have a whole chapter on that in the book. So, you know, I'll give, you know, a fairly everyday example. Someone wrote in the National Review this past week about a ban at a college on snowball fights. And she wrote about it as if this was, you know, extension of safe spaces, and that essentially this is the, you know, the term I don't really like, the snowflake generation can't handle snow fights. But I'm like, as a lawyer, I was looking at that and going, no, that's liability. Like that's them being concerned about someone, you know, losing an eye or whatever. But there are a lot of things that happen on campus that are made worse by the fact that someone in the general counsel's office is saying, do you really want to get sued about this? Now, the other sort of accelerant is federal regulation. And I believe I've talked about this on the podcast before, but the Department of Education has tremendous influence on how you define harassment on campus. Now, people, you know, immediately say harassment isn't freedom of speech. But what they often don't know is that the first speech codes of the quote unquote politically correct era of the late 1980s, early 1990s, and continuing through today were all just incredibly broad definitions of harassment that swept in huge amounts of merely offensive speech. So when the Department of Education comes back with their national blueprint and defines it as unwelcome speech of a sexual nature, whether or not a reasonable person would have been offended by it, that has a really terrifying effect on university general counsels, because they're like, how on earth am I supposed to comply with this other than over-complying? And we have seen cases across the country, including an ongoing case at Louisiana State University, where a female professor, was fired apparently for swearing at some point in class, because the university claimed because they were trying to follow the Department of Education's guidance on harassment. And so it's probably the phenomena that I've seen the most throughout my career that people don't get is that this interrelationship between the way universities run and federal regulation is one of the things that produce some of the more head-scratchy cases. Now, the good news is the Department of Education has repealed a number of these troubling guidances. You know, they're called guidances, but they're really effectively binding on universities. And so we have seen some progress on the federal level. On the cultural level on campus, I'm still pretty worried.
For parents who are concerned about this and for young people who are concerned that they themselves may not be the kind of resilient, capable people that they would like to be, what do you recommend?
One thing that was really important to both me and Height was that we, one, have real suggestions for what can be done at the end, but also that we make it very clear that we also are really looking forward to the discussion that the book provokes and to our, you know, the various places we're going to hear ideas from other people about what can be done. But one of the surprising conclusions that both of us came to was really getting behind the idea of making a cultural norm of gap year, essentially, students who are coming into college would really benefit from, you know, working a job in another part of the country for a year before they started college. That essentially some amount of real life experience that isn't, you know, directed like a rocket to make sure that you get into a fancy college, we think could do worlds of good to some of the problems we see on campus. And this is partially, you know, from my own experience working at FIRE. Non-traditional age students, particularly students who have either had real careers before going back to college or been in the military, they very often disproportionately get in trouble on campus for what they say in my experience at FIRE, partially because they're not really willing to put up with being talked to like they're, you know, incompetent, or that there's sort of like speech police that they should defer to. And I, of course, see that as kind of a good thing. I think that having that outside experience could really not just help the situation for free speech on campus, but also the situation for mental health on campus.
You also recommend cognitive behavioral therapy. And that's a chapter at the end of the book. Now, the cognitive behavioral therapy, you note, is easy to learn, but there's a lot of training involved in people who sort of shepherd people through that kind of therapy. Describe what that is and what it is meant to achieve.
I'm a huge advocate of cognitive behavioral therapy. I've personally benefited from it tremendously myself. But when I go to this sort of extra level of explaining the benefits of cognitive behavioral therapy, I always want people to sort of like forgive the tea at the end of it. I'm no longer really so much just saying the therapy by itself. Although if you have anxiety and depression, by all means, read books about it, practice it every day. It makes a huge difference to talking back to your sort of like anxious, unproductive thoughts. It's incredible in that respect. But I realized that working on campus, and one of the things that led to the first article that I worked on with Height, was that if we followed some of these simple kind of cognitive therapy guidelines, that essentially if we were to, rather than just ask our internal voice, am I catastrophizing internally? Am I overgeneralizing? Am I engaged in all or nothing thinking? Which is so great at calming down anxiety and depression if you make that a habit. If we actually practice that sort of outward as well, those are also happen to be, they're not just ways to argue fairly with yourself, but they're ways to argue fairly with each other. And I think that particularly given the sort of nasty, sort of polarized quagmire we're in, that it just sounds like a wonderful civil community and university community if people, before they made an argument, said, is this an overgeneralization? Is this catastrophizing? Is this any of these other cognitive distortions? So I think there's a tremendous amount we can learn from CBT. And if people are still uncomfortable with the idea of it being, you know, having the tea at the end being therapy, it's important to understand that cognitive behavioral therapy is essentially a real map to practicing stoicism. And it's not in its sort of like colloquial commandeering your emotions way, but in the way so like
– like name your fear.
Yeah. Talking about to lady philosophy, like I think talking back to your own thoughts. And so I'm just a very big advocate of using this as a way to have better discussions both internally and externally.
And as far as institutions are concerned, you know, we've heard, and it's perhaps unfortunate that the University of Chicago was made such a big deal out of the University of Chicago making just sort of a simple declaration about the kinds of speech that they would allow on campus and even encourage on campus. That makes them something of an outlier, making that sort of that statement. It's not clear how far it goes, but as far as colleges and institutions and even parents, what steps should they be taking to make sure that their kids are at least, you know, able to deal with risks and dangers that are appropriate to their ages?
This leads me to a point that I really want to hammer home to almost everybody I talk to. Because whenever, you know, Height and I talk about these issues, we get this sense of sort of fatalism that essentially universities have become so politically correct, you know, a term I don't particularly love, but that you can't have a meaningful discussion and that this is just the way it is and nothing can be done. And I want to pull my hair out because as far as like the latest trend of the sort of like the highly illiberal students, this is relatively new. The last time we saw something like this was like the late 80s, early 90s. And universities have just started to address it in any meaningful way. Basically, like my point is always, we have not even begun to fight this fight, and we're already acting like this is like, well, there's no way to resolve this. So University of Chicago drafts this very good statement, updating academic freedom norms for the age of trigger warnings and microaggressions and deplatforming and all that stuff. And at this point, I think nearly 40 schools around the country have adopted some version of it. I would like that to be every school in the country, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But when schools, you know, when administrators or parents or pundits complain about sort of like the situation for discourse and academic freedom and free speech on campus, as if there's nothing to be done, well, most universities, to our knowledge, don't even have a section in their orientations that explain the sophisticated, genuinely sophisticated philosophy behind academic freedom, freedom of speech, epistemic humility, all of these kind of things that don't come intuitively to us. If we're not teaching students these values and these philosophies, we shouldn't really be shocked that they don't understand them.
As I ask everyone, what surprised you most about doing this project?
So the two most surprising things that I discovered in the course of working on this book with Height One was, of course, how dramatically the situation for mental health had deteriorated for young people just over the past couple of years. Now, that was, of course, a very negative thing to discover. The positive thing that what I see as a positive thing is discovering how well established it is that unstructured free playtime, how beneficial it is to children. Erica Christakis's great book, The Importance of Being Little, really hit you over the head with this, saying it's like, listen, the research is just over and over again. You have to give your children, you know, unstructured time to play. Play is actually really essential to developing, you know, a sense of competency in the real world. And what was so shocking about seeing how well established this was looking at all my, you know, friends who are parents and how it seems to be that the expectation is that your kid is scheduled from 6 a.m. to bedtime every day. And even though we're not listening to this advice, I think there's a growing movement that we should be listening to this advice. But it also leads to the idea that we may actually be able to get to a childhood that looks less like a dysfunctional pressure cooker that is like, you know, making students, you know, neurotic in one way and not competent enough and others, to something that celebrates free time, that celebrates play, that actually is both that feels good and is also good for a generation of students still to come.
Greg Lukianoff is co-author of the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, out now. You can subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes, Google Podcasts, and when you think about it, say, Alexa, play the Cato Daily Podcast. And you can follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.